This is KUAC-FM in Fairbanks, and it's 7 o'clock and time for the Home Fires radio show with Patty Kostelic.
Little thing?
It is little thing. Good evening and welcome to Home Fires radio show. Tonight, luckily, I have a guest in the studio, and he's a personal friend of mine. And anyone who caught my wonderful show last week knows that he was also my boss, Jim Holm, co-owner with his wife, Anita, of Northern Lights Garden Center. Center?
Which encompasses a whole bunch of things, but
Center,
that's true.
Right. Mm-hmm. Northern Lights Garden Center. And anyone who's listened to this show on a more or less regular basis knows that I am not an expert, but I have a passion for gardening. And I spent a considerable number of hours out in my yard working on it as a result today, as I'm sure did many of you. So we're going to talk about gardening. The phone lines are open tonight. They are 474-5044. If you will just call with any of your questions on gardening, I know that everyone is getting into gear right now, and you probably have a lot of questions. You may be, I know, I take my radio to my garden. They may be out digging still, Jim, because it is light and it is not raining at the moment.
Well, it's not raining at the moment, but it was a little bit ago, but it looks like it's cleared
off. That will make it hard to dial the phone if you've got your hands full of dirt. But the number is 474-5044, and I encourage all of you to call with your questions about gardening because Jim is an expert. Jim, tell me a little bit about your background. In fact, I also worked with your father, John, and we planted many thousand tomato seeds together. And John, in fact, was on my program early last summer, and he truck gardened on Farmer's Loop.
No, on Chena Hot Springs Road at that time. My father came here in 1946 and homesteaded on Steel Creek Road at that time. And I don't know if your audience is familiar with where Henry Gettinger is now, but that was our homestead. And if I recall, he hacked out the first 5 acres with an axe. And that's where I grew up. I was 18 months old, I believe, when we came here.
From where?
Well, I was born in California, and that's where my parents, I believe, got married. But my brother was born in Minnesota. But then, anyway, we came up here in 1946. And then my father homesteaded for 14 or 15 years. In the interim, we also had a nursery on the farm of about 5 to 10 acres. And then in 1959, he sold the farm, and we put the nursery in where it is now on College Road, which happened to be the first piece of ground that Charlie Kramer, who owned Kramer's uh-huh. Dairy at that time, ever sold. So,
Charlie own it at that time?
If I recall, he owned two sections. He owned from College Road all the way to Farmer's Loop and slightly above Farmer's Loop, so a block, a mile wide, 2 miles long.
And College Road was there at that time, although
I believe so.
Dirt road?
I believe so. Of course, I wasn't old enough to remember that.
Do you have any idea why you sold that particular piece off? That was...
Well, it was right on the corner. It was probably the only piece he could get rid of without doing anything that would affect him much.
Because it's really, in fact, close to the farm proper. When I worked for you, I used to go in with my brown bag lunch and go over to Creamer's Field and rest my aching muscles.
Bones. Yes.
And watch the geese and ducks fly in and eat a bologna sandwich. So it's really very close right there.
Oh, yes, right.
So that's interesting that he didn't, with two sections, pick the opposite.
Well, it could have been right in the middle of Wedgwood Manor, I suspect. But but either or, that's the area.
What kind of, when you were still on Steel Creek, what kind of nursery stock did your father have?
Well, just about everything we have now. We have some perennials that we didn't have then, and we have some variances. Wing crab apple, for example, is a new one over the years that is a selection that we have available. But there were a lot of things we could grow there that we can't grow here. The sorbus, the mountain ash, we could grow on the homestead, and we can't grow where we are now.
Because where you are now is colder?
We're just too cold, right.
Hmm.
There are many of them that can grow in the upper hills, and there are different secluded areas around town. There's one in front of the Christian Science Monitor building downtown. Or Christian Science building, I mean, mm-hmm. That is just absolutely gorgeous. But I can't grow them. We brought when we moved from the homestead in 59, we brought 5,000 or 1,000 or just a whole bunch of them down. I don't recall exactly the number, but we lost all of them. I think maybe five lived.
Actually, that is a frustrating thing about gardening here. I know that we live out, we live between the airport and the Chena River, and we are really in a cold spot and
yes.
mm-hmm. Have some wonderful gardening soil that we've worked on steadily, and it really does very well in many respects. But one of the annoying things is that if there's a frost,
you're the first people to get it.
Yeah, we really are. And we've even had the first summer I was here, I almost said the first winter, the first summer I was here, on August 16th, there was a hard freeze on our property, and I lost a lot of things, of course, the dahlias and glads that were just about to
bloom and then
bloom and so on, all went. And I had certain varieties of flowers that did not freeze at the airport, and they had the same varieties, and I covered mine, and they didn't. And so that's less than a quarter of a mile. And
it's
so
just amazing the little microclimates that are around this town. excuse me, we're in a real pothole ourselves. I remember years ago, KCBF, but it used to be KFRB, which transmitted right on the corner, right next to us, had always the coldest reading in town, and just every bit as cold as Badger Road.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good trial ground. If something will grow for us there, I can be doggone well sure that it's at least hardy.
Right. And then we can go one step more and either take it to Badger Road or to my place and figure out if it's really ready to face the outer limits. Okay, I'm just going to sit here and ask Jim all of my favorite gardening questions unless you call in. So the number is 474-5044, and you may not even hear about the varieties you're interested in if you don't call. Peonies, are those marginal in Fairbanks? Because I have seen some absolutely fabulous peony bushes downtown. And
well, I don't think they're marginal. I don't think that's the right
word.
Term. Peonies don't like to be moved, for one thing. Normally when peonies are moved, they reject the movement pretty severely. They really don't like to be moved. So if you do move them, you have to let them go for a couple of years before they develop a good enough root structure that they then will bloom.
How do you start them?
They're cut apart just like rhubarb. They're not grown from seed. They're cut from the root is a very fibrous, pithy root like a rhubarb root, and you just take the crowns and cut them apart and make sure you have two or three buds on each
but
crown.
But expect like a two-year setback?
Oh, I would say 2 to 3 is probably an average. Once you get a peony established, it's an absolutely gorgeous flower.
It is.
And they do quite well here. One of the little peculiar glitches they have is they do not like to sit in water, so make sure you have very good well-drained soil.
I remember in Wisconsin, we lived on a dairy farm for a while outside of Madison, and there were peony bushes there that were so big, I was 5 or 6 years old, I could crawl under them. They were like hiding places, just in these huge mammoth maroon and pink.
The flowers smell so good, too.
So
a lot of people
fragrant.
Don't realize that they are so fragrant, and they are a very good cut flower. But it's kind of hard to cut a peony that's 10 inches across and put it into anything that makes an arrangement. I mean, it almost has to be just an arrangement
real
of
gaudy.
Peonies. Pretty gaudy, right.
Okay, lilacs are another. I'm just talking about some perennials here. Maybe we should at the beginning here just discuss some perennials in general. Lilacs, are there any special tricks to getting lilacs going? Because they're another bush that the old cabins and houses downtown seem to have some wonderful stands of lilacs.
Right. Most of the Nokomis of the French lilacs are not hardy here. On occasion, there are a few that in the right microclimate, as we talked before, do okay as a short lilac. When they get up above the snow line, they don't do well at all. Now, that's the French lilac, the one that you buy when you're buying a cut lilac, and the one that most people are familiar with in Virginia and some of those places. Here we have one that comes out of Canada originally, if I recall, and is a Velosa syringa, which is not really color specific, but it is normally a lilac or a light pink, or and sometimes it can be darker purple, but generally it's a lilac or light pink. Does very well. It moves very well, has a pretty dense root structure. The one thing that comes to mind that would make, or there's a couple things that would make a difference how they bloom. One is that if you prune it, to shape it, you want to do the pruning right after it blooms in the spring or in mid-June, because what happens then is that it develops buds for the following year in the fall, and those buds then are your blooms. If you cut it in the spring, you cut off all your blooms because lilacs only bloom on the tips.
I see.
And I've known of several cases where people have come to me and they said, my lilac never blooms. And I said, well, when do you prune it? And they say, well, I prune it first thing in the spring.
Right.
Well, the problem with that is they cut off all their blooms. And so the minute they quit doing that, it does fine. And just a good high phosphate or a good garden fertilizer is just great for them.
We're building a greenhouse this year off a shop that Sam built
right.
last fall.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a deck, and you were saying something about perennials. They don't want warm feet.
Well, you have a real problem. If they have warm, there's a relationship between warm feet and cold feet. If it gets too cold, they don't like that either. So what has to happen is that the plant has to grow as it can entertain the air temperature, and so those have to be commensurate with each other. If it's too warm, the plant grows too early, and then you get a frost, it's down to zero or something, it drops the whole top of the plant off. And it depends upon what kind of recovery levels they have.
Mm-hmm.
If it's somewhat protected and it comes up early, no problem. There's a lovely tulip bed off Lathrop that's got a heated foundation close to it, and it's just absolutely
just
gorgeous.
The right combination.
But the right combination has to be there. And so I would just tell people that, you know, try one or try two or... You know, you could try a half a dozen tulip bulbs or something in a nice area, but don't get carried away with buying 100 of them and then losing the whole crop, because it certainly isn't financially rewarding or a good chance to take.
For anyone who grew up in the Midwest, of course, bulbs were one of the most foolproof kinds of gardening. People who didn't do anything else put a bunch of daffodils and crocus and tulips in the ground in the fall with a little bone meal, and that was just the
you
first.
You definitely had flowers, right?
You definitely had flowers.
We're not so fortunate.
That's true. And I've even tried them on in my refrigerator with the only marginal luck coming up.
Yeah, it. We have a long winter. And
no kidding.
We all know this, and so one of the problems that we have is trying to hold things for that duration of period without having them attract fungal diseases and things that are going to destroy the bulbs. I think a lot of the problems that people have in storing certain types of bulbs are that they keep them slightly too cold, which causes them to absorb a little more moisture than they really would have if they were kept more like onions are traditionally kept instead of like potatoes. They tend to do a little better, or having good air circulation around them, they aren't going to start rotting so quickly.
Okay, for the benefit of the audience, what's the difference between the way you keep onions versus the way you keep potatoes?
Well, usually onions are kept around 45 to 50 degrees, whereas potatoes are kept between 38 and 42. And then, I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot. It's a lot more critical than you would think.
Root cellars are not all that simple here either.
Well, they're not bad. They're not that hard to do. It's just that you have to have air circulation to keep that surface dry so that the funguses do not attack the surface.
So you need some kind of small fan?
Yeah, small squirrel cage blower, something mm-hmm. to keep that air circulating, some way to vent the humidity levels if they get too high.
My grandparents homesteaded in Canada, and I might have mentioned that last week. My brain was in a sort of fog as I was forced to sort of go on myself, but my grandmother had a trap door in her bedroom, and she went down the stairs, and they had a root cellar right beneath their bedroom, and they lived north of Edmonton on the Alcan Highway in a little town called San Gudo. And they kept dry storage, cold dry storage, kept most of the root crops, all the turnips, the carrots, the onions, the potatoes, and so on, right through the winter. I mean, that was the main source of...
Yeah, we did it here, too, the same way. It works quite well. It's just a matter of having enough area so that you can do it. I know that a lot of people use sand, and they'll put celery in sand and carrots in sand, and you can take them out, and they'll be absolutely delightful.
Mm-hmm.
Cabbage, we stored tons and tons of cabbage, and about the only thing that happens is the outer leaves or the wrapper leaves will turn yellow, and you peel them off, and you don't know the difference. I mean, they're absolutely great.
Now, I know that there are a lot of people like Ellen Iote out there who's going to just cringe, but I'm really happier with our dry storage than I am with the kind of vegetables that we freeze. I'm very conscientious about the freezing, but I think the dry storage has almost been better for us, at any rate. You know, the potatoes and carrots and so on, they feel like really fresh vegetables versus the frozen ones don't have the fresh.
Well, the consistencies do change. There's no doubt mm-hmm. about that. But if they're blanched properly, as you well know, things mm-hmm. like cauliflower and broccoli and Brussels sprouts.
Cold crops.
And, you know, your cold crops, they'd be excellent. And, mm-hmm. you know, storage of carrots, my goodness, that's a piece of cake. Mm-hmm. They're not hard to store. And celery, which is a lot of people don't realize is a good crop here, mm-hmm. stores extremely well.
Is it necessary to put those little gallon milk containers around them?
The best ones I've ever had were from a lady that used to live down on 6th Avenue, and it was in the middle of December, and I recall that we had fresh celery, and all she did was pack it in sand, dry sand.
But when she grew it, did she put milk cartons around it?
Well, you can do that. You mean first, keeping it white? Well, that's the only reason you would do that, is just to keep the stalk length white so they don't photosynthesize, just to keep them from getting any light, but... No, when
it
she
doesn't
just
keep
them
together, and it, I don't grow
no,
celery.
No, usually they're tied. You can tie them, or they usually grow together. If you tie them, they'll just stay nice and tight together.
I don't know why we don't grow celery, but I don't grow celery. I'm not.
Well, it's a great crop here. It's a very nice crop, and in fact, I personally believe it's one of the finest crops we grow. I think we grow as good a celery as can be grown in the world. It tastes just delightful.
Okay, we'll assume no one's calling us. They're all out in their garden digging. 474-5044.
Or out of town.
Or out of town. No, I think they're. I heard I was listening to APRN last night, and they were talking about things that people do on Memorial Day weekend, and people were talking about going out on their boats and fishing. And mm-hmm. So one guy, this was all out of Anchorage, and one guy was saying, you know, for the first few miles, there's so many boats out there. The only place you can put your line is right directly at the back of your boat. Your boat. And I'm thinking, my parents always gardened on Memorial Day, and it never occurs to me to leave town or to do one of those sort of typical recreational kind of things, because that's when you're getting the dead leaves out of your perennial beds and deciding what you're going to move around this year. And
and you better get to it now.
And
now's the time to do it.
Fairbanks, it's critical. We have no... not very much margin.
Yeah, we have a pretty narrow window here. If you notice how quick it goes from the time that the buds turn swell to the time the buds turn green or the leaves come out, it's a pretty narrow window to be moving things around. This year was more narrow than most.
Why do you say that?
Well, in past years, we've been able to dig much earlier in the nursery, uh-huh. as a general rule of thumb, and this year it was quite late.
I found it heartbreaking this year. Then all the old-timers tell me, I don't know why you feel this way. It's like this every year. But there was a period at the end of March where it was just
gorgeous,
singingly great. And you just thought, maybe this is the year that this wonderful weather, this uplifting weather, will stick, and it will just get consistently warmer and warmer. And, of course, it didn't. I mean, it didn't get beastly, but it really...
Mother Nature's rather fickle, isn't she?
Yes. And so the soil, and that's the critical thing here. I think a lot of people who are beginning gardeners don't realize that the critical thing at the beginning of the year is the soil temperature, that the air can be, in fact, very warm. But if the soil is...
It takes time for that soil to...
cold and frozen, that the seeds don't like it, plants don't like it, everything gets shocked when they go into it. Just as a sort of general list, let's assume that there are some people out there who are not experienced gardeners in Fairbanks. What are our really good crops? Because it took me a long time to make a transition from the South to here. I mean, certain things, my beloved okra, I knew I had to give that up, but...
I know a lot of people that grow okra in the greenhouse here.
In the greenhouse, I know, but it's...
And so, I mean, there are some options. There are an awful lot of greenhouses here, and for those items that are warm soil crops, greenhouses are good...
With raised beds.
Good and option here. I mean, fine.
Okra, to me, traditionally is something, though, that takes up considerable amount of space.
Versus what your return
is. Tomatoes, right.
Probably the most profitable things you can grow are things you can freeze. Cabbage is not necessarily a profitable crop. For example, a cabbage is very cheap in the store. It doesn't taste the same when it's not fresh, you know, if you get it in the later season when it came out of storage. But some things are really profitable and some are not. Now, for this terms of what are really the best crops, we grow excellent carrots here as long as we have raised beds. If mm-hmm. if the soil is up high enough so that it's warm, carrots do excellent. Peas are a very good crop here.
Any special varieties that you...
Oh, there's many of them. There are many good varieties. Sparkle's a good one. Gosh, I can't.
You like
Green
Sugar
Arrow
Snap?
Is a good one. Sugar Snap, Sugar Bon.
Sugar Snaps are the new ones. Well, they're not new anymore. They're two, three years, maybe more. But they're sort of a cross between a Chinese
edible potted, full-blown pea so that you can eat them as edible potted peas.
For those people who do not like shelling peas, I remember my...
Yes.
My grandmother, there used to be haying crews out there, and we'd have to prepare lunch, which consisted of six chickens that had to have their heads cut off and be all plucked, and potatoes and so on. And all of it was fairly simple, but when we had cream peas on the menu, that was 4 hours of pea shelling.
That's pea shucking. Yep. Shuck peas and made little pea boats and put them in the water and put the little sticks in them. Oh, yes.
What?
Didn't you ever make a boat with a pea shell?
No.
Oh, yeah.
How do you
it's great
do that?
Fun. I'd have to show you. I don't know if I could explain
it. Not
this,
on radio.
One you of the things we do, and you just pull the string on it and then pop it open, take the peas out, and put a little stick in between it so it spreads it like a canoe.
Uh-huh.
And you get fancy and put a little toothpick in there and a little sail on it.
I was very much into hollyhock dolls, but not... Not pea boats. Hollyhock dolls
That's
can get
back
very
in those 5 and 6 year old days, but
very elaborate. Well, we have a gardener who's joining us. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Nothing. I don't know. We will
try again.
Yeah, odd. Just hold with us. We'll figure out where you are. Anyway, we made a lot of hollyhock dolls. Do hollyhocks do well here?
No.
No.
There are a couple of varieties that we grow. One's Althea Zebrina, which is the old-fashioned hollyhock. It's actually a single hollyhock, and it's a good annual flower, but it's not a perennial.
In the Midwest, they're a perennial.
Yes.
And
their
whole
right.
fences yeah. full of
Catos and a lot
hollyhocks
of different types
and
of powder
doubles
puffs.
And so on. And so
I've
forth.
Heard that people have had them live over here, but I have never seen one that lived over.
We'll get back to our garden list. I just want to digress, I'm sorry, for a minute. A little bit about delphiniums. When you see old cabins sort of falling down, you can sometimes see just huge stands of delphiniums. Do they have special requirements? Are they hard to get going?
No, they're very easy to grow. They have a few problems. Aspen tortrix, which is a worm that we get in our aspen trees here, is a real problem. But other than cutworms and those types of things, we do have problem. We don't have any problems with growing them. And that is the flower of Fairbanks.
Delphinium. Okay, yes. You are on the air now. Hello?
Hi. I have a lot of trouble with tomatoes. They always seem to get, I guess it's a fungus around the stem where it goes into the ground. And I really don't know anything about them, but I wondered if you could talk about them.
Surely. First, tell me something. Are they in the greenhouse or the outside?
Outside.
Outside. Do you use elevated beds?
Well...
Or pots? Or
they were in tubs.
Okay, in a tub, I would plant them higher in the tub. For one thing, what happens is the air as it moves across the lip of the tub, if you can imagine this, does not go down into the pot, but skips over the top of the pot and doesn't really dry that area around that stem. Now, if you're having a lot of problem with that, I would suggest that you would remove some of the lower leaves so that the light gets into there, for one thing. The other thing, you can use fungicides, of course, on them, like Captan, that will stop a lot of that problem. But if you're adverse to using fungicides on them, if you'll remove some of the lower leaves so you get better light and... watch your watering so that you don't water them until the surface does dry every day, then it should eliminate a lot of that problem.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, good luck.
I'll try it. Thanks.
The cotyledons are the first two little, not true leaves, but the first little leaves
from
that,
the seed.
From
right.
the seed that, mm-hmm. that come out. With tomatoes, you bury the cotyledon for greenhouse varieties?
Well, generally you'll take the cotyledons off.
Off. But for outdoor varieties,
they're determinate, which means that they are a short plant. In other words, the plant will not grow indeterminately. As a general rule of thumb, you don't do any pruning on tomatoes that are determinate growers, which are outdoor varieties, other than the fact that if the plant, as this lady did mention, that she seems to have a shielding problem, she can remove the major leaves, but don't remove the laterals, which are the side branches that come out from the crotch where that leaf comes off originally. That's not true with a greenhouse variety. You would remove the lateral branching as it comes out because you want it to produce very healthy tomatoes off the main stem.
Okay.
Does it make sense?
So you keep those little leaves that come out in the Y.
Yeah, they're little
plucked off for the
right,
greenhouse
for the
varieties,
greenhouse only.
And you do not trim the outside varieties
no.
like our Subarctic 25.
No.
I think we'll continue to talk about tomatoes, but do you have any other specific questions?
No, I think they've never gotten very far because of this, so I'll try this and see what happens.
Okay.
Okay, what are you fertilizing with, too? I didn't realize you were still on the line. Pardon me.
Well, I don't even know the numbers. Do you have a suggestion?
Yes, I would suggest that you use a fairly high phosphate, which is the center number. So if you use something like a 15-30-15, 10-52-10, 10-52-17, 9-45-15, if you'll notice that center number is always two or three times higher than everything else. That's what you should use for any flowering crops. Once you have established that plant to being at a stage where it should be blooming, in other words, when it's a little tiny guy, you want the roots to grow equally as well as the stem and the leaves. But when you want it to get it to bloom, then you hit it with that center number, and that forces it into blooming.
And that's a fairly general rule.
Yeah, that's a real general rule. And that doesn't really, you know, I shouldn't say that that's true for everything you want to do, but...
But it is something that you follow, and I know that in the greenhouse when we were working, we were just trying to get the plants established, we'd use very even kinds of
something
amounts.
Something like 20-20-20, 23-19-17,
as we're heading toward the blooming season, and you want to...
And we jack up that center number to make sure that
put the blooms
that
on so you don't have all leaves. Now, nasturtiums are sort of...
Weird ducks. they don't want food.
Weird example of it. Nasturtiums do not like very rich soil, and although they're very, I understand, good for the garden in terms of being pest deterrents, they're hard to grow in a garden that has real good soil in terms of flowering.
Well, they don't flower a lot. You'll get a lot of vegetation, but not many flowers.
Our phone number is 4745044. For anyone who wants to call. I haven't mentioned that for a while. 4745044. So nasturtiums are odd. But in general, once you get to the stage that you want plants to flower, you worry about the phosphate content. The other thing that I didn't realize when I first came here, because I grew up in the Midwest, and in the Midwest, tomatoes were tomatoes, and it just depended on your taste, whether you wanted beefsteaks or whether you wanted more meat and less juice or so on and so forth. But now I realize in Fairbanks there are outside varieties and greenhouse varieties.
Well, primarily because of what we talked about before, the determinate and indeterminate varieties, the determinate varieties will tolerate the cold weather better than the indeterminate varieties. And so if you have a plant that doesn't produce tomatoes until it gets 4 or 5 feet tall, it, with our cold soils, it rarely ever gets 4 or 5 feet tall, so consequently it rarely ever produces much in the way of a crop.
So watch the varieties and make sure that you choose outdoor tomatoes.
Absolutely.
For,
and
for
not
outdoor.
Not all determinate growers are really good outdoor tomatoes, but as a general rule, some they are.
Okay. I have two more callers, so I'm going to move on. Thank you for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, would you please talk about how to start forget-me-nots around the house?
Well, that's pretty easy. You can buy the seed, and they germinate quite well from seed, or any of the nurseries around town, I'm sure, handle them. I know we certainly do, as starter plants.
Are they perennials?
Are they special seeds? Because those that I had tried for several years just don't come up.
Okay, Myosotis alpestris is the one that's the is fairly hardy. Okay. Semper florens is sometimes hardy, but tends to reseed quite well. And there are many variations. Some of them are called, right off the top of my head, I can't tell you all the names of them. But there are many different types. I would stay away from the Chinese forget-me-not, because
okay.
It is not.
Uh-huh. But the soil has to be just plain old soil, or it doesn't need sand?
Well, a good garden soil, it doesn't have to be anything real fancy. I don't find that forget-me-nots are hard to grow at all. And
do they need a lot of sun or shade or what?
Reasonably good light.
Good light?
Yes.
How long is the germination period?
10 days, if I recall.
Okay,
they're pretty fast.
But it's critical to keep soil, when the seeds are germinating, to keep it moist. And I think a lot of people have germination problems because they let it...
If you forget it at the wrong time, you lose it, not because they aren't going to germinate, but because you actually lose the hypocotyl, or the little beginning root. You lose it at the wrong time, then it doesn't ever develop, and so consequently the seed never becomes a plant.
Is it too late to start now?
No, it's absolutely fine to start now.
Okay.
They won't bloom as early as they would if you started a month ago, but, you know, you still will get them.
They are perennial, so they would come year after year once they get a good...
They are not the same one that we have here that's indigenous to the area in the mountains. But there is no source for that seed that I know of, so we have to live with that.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. I'm interested in starting a flower bed in the northwest corner of my yard. It's under the overhang from my house, so it does not have direct sunlight. It's also a little dry. Could you name some perennials and annuals that might do well there?
In terms of perennials, you have a problem. And the problem is that without snow cover, almost without exception, no perennial would live.
Yes, I imagine I'd have to throw some snow over it in the winter to protect any perennials that I had there.
Okay, if you're in a northern area, there are a few, there aren't a lot. One is Hosta, which is a blue flowered, I don't really know how to explain the plant, but it's called a... Oh, come on, mind. Anyway, the Hosta has a blue flower, and it looks like a little bit of like a lily, and it does fairly well in shady areas. It does have to have snow cover. Lily of the Valley, which is quite common, Convallaria, is a good perennial. It tends to run. You kind of almost have to have some way to keep it in bounds because it runs through the soil like quackgrass, but it's a good perennial. And the ferns, of course. Columbine does reasonably well. It doesn't seem to bloom as well in the shade, but you should get them. Trolleus is not a bad one. It's a globe flower, but it like the rest of them, it doesn't bloom as well. That's all that really comes to mind. False spirea, as far as a bush, lilacs will do in that area, but they won't bloom as well.
Do you have any annuals that would do well?
Quite a few. Begonias, wax begonias, impatiens, ageratum, lobelia, alyssum. Monkey flower, which is mimulus. It's it's a
very
gorgeous
pretty,
flower.
Really
it's,
pretty.
It's also perennial in Valdez, but it's not here. Johnny jump ups, pansies. Mm-hmm. You know, any of that family.
Johnny jump ups actually reseed themselves very.
Very common.
Very common. For
sometimes the plant will live over, and some of the violas, you know, or all of the violas, and you'll get plenty of color, and I'm sure that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But wax begonias are a gorgeous thing. There are some really nice things that are available.
That prefer shade.
That prefer shade, that actually burn out if you put them in the sun, that don't do well.
All right, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Pansies do okay in the sun, but they don't mind
a reasonable amount of shade. No, and they are also the best tolerant, most tolerant of frost of any flower you can grow.
We lost a couple of callers, and I'd like to apologize. I'm sorry. Either I'm not fast enough on the phones or something's happening, and I do apologize for that. So if you'd like to call back, all our lines are open, and the number is 474-5044. that, I guess here we are sort of a week before the weekend. This is the long weekend, and it is also the weekend before our absolute safe date, isn't that?
Well, that's the absolute safe date is a kind of a misnomer, because I've seen years when it is and isn't, but generally true.
Okay, I think we have
somebody
several
on.
Well, there are lots of callers here, and I'm not even sure what I'm supposed to do first.
Well, we'll plug along. Punch a button.
I guess I can. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I just want to make a comment about the forget-me-nots. I tried them for the first time this year, and only three germinated. I was real surprised. I have something called Bluebird.
Okay.
Is that not a good...
What temperature did you try and germinate them at?
Oh, I did it in the house. It's fairly cool in here.
Okay. One of the things that happens with most seeds, now this is not true with 100% of things, but if you can raise the soil temperature to about 80 degrees, you will get much better germination. And I mean from the difference of 50% to 90%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can rule out water, if you can rule out putting the seed too deeply into the medium that you're using, temperature probably is another key. Also, I don't recall, but they may be negatively phototropic, and I just don't remember. That's why I have books. But they may have a problem with
that
light.
That means they like to be covered. Although they need to be shallow, they may need to be covered.
They may need to be covered
away from light
with a dark something to get them germinated. I just don't know that for a fact, but I don't know why you would have such a bad germination unless it was temperature related.
Yeah, I didn't have trouble with other things. It was just a forget-me-not.
Well, some things are more sensitive than others.
Yes.
And if it was a light related thing, then I just, you know, I have to beg, plead ignorance on it because I just don't remember.
Uh-huh. Now, the main question I had is that in my greenhouse, I noticed that around certain plants, especially peppers, there's a light green, there's a green mossy like substance that grows on the soil. And I was wondering if you know what that is and if it's harmful in any way.
Well, it's probably an algal growth or a moss growth, either one. Generally, it grows in areas where you have the soils a little tighter than it should be. You might loosen your soil up with perlite or a little bit more sand or something in the soil so that it does drain better, because what's happening is the water is sitting on the surface and the algae will grow, or the mosses will grow because they've got so much water available to them.
Is it harmful to the plant?
Well, not, excuse me, not really. You have a problem with it stealing fertilizer from you and water from you, and also will make an impervious layer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a crab apple that I got last year from Northern Lights, and I planted it lovingly, and it doesn't seem to have wintered over very well. And I was wondering if there's something I can give it to sort of give it an extra boost.
Is it leafed out now?
No, it's got some buds, but it's got quite a few branches that don't have any buds.
There really isn't anything to do if you have winter damage other than get another one. Last year was a real strange year in that we didn't get any snow cover until December, and it got very cold. And it affected several things that we have never lost in the nursery in 40 years, you know, since my dad's been doing it. And just amazing. But that particular crab apple is the hardiest that we have. And we lost a few in the field, too. Very few, but we lost a few in the field, too. And it's kind of the chance we take.
Well, I'd say about 30% of the branches have buds. Should I call that lost, or?
No, and I probably wouldn't do anything for another 2 weeks. Because it may be just some latent winter damage, and it may show up so that you don't need to take all the branches off, and you can prune it back to some type of shape. But the winter last year was very, very hard.
Anything you can feed it to help, bone meal or?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, as long as it's leafing out, I'd give it some fertilizer. You know, you definitely give it some garden fertilizer or a good soluble fertilizer to get it going this spring. But there isn't much we can do about Mother Nature.
I find that true in Fairbanks. It's hard to get things established. Once they're established and they get a certain minimum growth, they seem to be easier to winter over. But when you first put them in, it's sort of difficult to get them to take
hold. Well, they haven't really established a root system, you know, that really allows them to survive. Mm-hmm. They don't have any storage capacity like they will as soon as they get well established. And so, you know, if the plant's a little weaker as it goes in, you know, after you move it, of course, it is slightly weaker.
Mm-hmm. And if it's planted in a place that the soil is cool, and there are many places where the soil is cool throughout the summer, even in a warm summer, you just don't get a lot of root growth.
Well, of course not. And of course, that maybe not as a...
And it was like, planted in the fall anyway, so...
Sure. Well, it's kind of hard to tell whether it's a genetic cold hardiness problem or a physiological problem, mm-hmm. you know, as Patty was talking about. And that's...
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, good luck to you.
Uh-huh, bye-bye.
I hope it sprouts a lot more leaves in the next week.
So do I.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. Can you tell me if the perennial herbs such as sage and spearmint sold in the greenhouses really do come back?
Sage does not. Spearmint on occasion. The Crispa mentha is what I'm trying to think. I'm sure that's the right name. But anyway, the wild mint, or the one that's commonly known as wild mint, is quite perennial here. It's the most reliable. Spearmint and peppermint on occasion. They're not what are called reliable perennials. We do not sell them as perennials.
Okay. Can you tell me how to grow asparagus? I planted some last year, and they didn't come back, or they haven't yet.
Okay, asparagus is not duck. The best place I've ever seen it grow, we used to grow it on the farm, and it lived beautifully. It never produced any asparagus. I produced things about the size of a pencil or less, and they were woody, and they bolted right up and went to seed. The problem, I think, is a lot of it is our light. Asparagus really doesn't like our light that much. However, I've seen it grow well on given years at the university, several different varieties. Frebo, a friend of mine has some Mary Washington. It's absolutely gorgeous stuff, and it's on the south side of her house, and she's got a heated basement, and it's absolutely gorgeous, but she gets it first thing in the spring. Mm-hmm. And after that, of course, you don't get a long cropping of it, so... I guess you have to just try it, and if it works for you, fine. If it doesn't, fine, too, but that's...
This is the fourth year that we've had an asparagus bed, and we nurture it. We put styrofoam bats and horse manure and straw and so on and so forth. We go to all lengths, and it had a tough first year, and then we're very hopeful and nurturing of it. But of course, we have yet to have one spear, and that, in fact, asparagus, even in the Midwest, is, they call it a crop of the true gardener, because you plant it, and even if you plant two-year-old roots, you do not expect a good harvest till the third year. And so that takes some kind of investment in time and effort.
But it has to live over
to the
third year.
But it has to
live
over it. In the Midwest, of course, once you get a good bed established, you have an asparagus bed for 20 years. And there are people who have asparagus growing in their yards where presumably some previous house owner had a garden at one point. I think it may be like corn here. Since I grew up in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois, you know, corn has a special meaning to me, and I'm just totally disgusted with Fairbanks corn, so I won't even try
well,
it.
Reminds me of your earlier comment, what's a good crop? That isn't on the top of the list. That's probably asparagus is close to the bottom.
And corn, but on the other hand, I have talked to and I have read about people that are real serious about corn on the cob. Of course, in the Midwest, you know, they say you must have the pot boiling with the water, you run to the backyard, you pick the corn, you silk it, and you drop it in so that the sugar doesn't convert to starch, and that's
right.
The only way. So when you get a good crop of fresh corn, it's really rewarding, as is asparagus. But I have heard of people who've had, in given years, great corn crops here, but you're going to try...
Well, I grow watermelon in the greenhouse, you know, and this kind of tickles me. It's the same type of thing, the sugar baby watermelon, or the little watermelon... that would grow in the greenhouse. They're about the size of a cantaloupe, and and you pick them and you chill them and you eat them and you tell yourself they taste good because you grew them.
Uh-huh.
But you can buy a lot better watermelon at 14 cents a pound in Market Basket.
And in fact, in Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas, where I lived recently, they grow in the fields.
Oh, absolutely.
By the millions. It's like a seed crop, a field crop that they don't take any special care at all.
That's true.
So anyway, I think those of us who come from other places gardening, there are some things that we're just loath to give up and we're going to persist with no matter what. And asparagus,
come
I agree with
high
you.
Water,
it
you know we're
going
to do
mine,
it. That's right.
But,
well, that's the only reason I grow watermelon, really. Plus, the kids like to grow them, so cantaloupe and stuff. But
I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
No, you're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have a few minutes if anyone else would like to call. I would like to get back to my question about this weekend. I understand that there are no hard and fast rules about when it's going to freeze and so on. But what could one, without holding you to this, reasonably do in the garden this weekend? We still have a couple of days here.
Well, I would do anything that didn't have to do with cucurbits, and which are the squash family, the cucumbers, tomatoes, I'd be very, very suspect in the putting into the ground. Marigolds, zinnias, any
dahlias
of the warm
easily
dahlias. You can cool them. You can put them out during the day and getting them hardened off. But I wouldn't get really carried away. It's cool today, and it's supposed to get fairly cool tonight. So, you know, these plants will tolerate 40, but they aren't going to tolerate 38. I mean, they aren't going to like it. So
right. And so it sets them back.
Oh, surely. You don't gain a thing. I recall several years ago I proved to my wife that I could start a zucchini from a seed in the ground on the 1st of June and beat her transplant that was a month old on the 1st of June, and they produced the same day. So, I mean, there are some things that if you get started too early, you don't gain a thing.
Again, back to soil temperature. Soil temperature is the critical factor, and if you put seeds in the ground, they may not rot or freeze, but they just won't take off.
They won't do anything. So if you start too early, you know, but like potatoes, you know, you can get those in as soon as you can work
potatoes,
the soil.
And I do, I have an absolute love of sweet peas, so I have my sweet peas in, but I have sort of a cold frame that I created with our storm windows.
Keep them warm.
To try and keep them warm. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I had a question. I've tried several years to grow the Shasta daisies a garden where all the other flowers seem to grow just fine. Is there any trick to getting them established?
Not really. Shasta daisy is not a reliable perennial. It's a real borderline. If you've got a good place for it, fine, but don't bank on it.
Okay, that answers the question, I guess.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, but that's the way it is.
I think there are a number of borderline perennials that many of us are used to just being very predictable, and here's some you get the right location with the... They work and...
Yeah, there aren't many that are fail-safe. There are a few that are pretty well fail-safe.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I wondered if it would be practical, if we have saturated soil, to grow lilacs on some type of a raised bed, a large raised bed.
Talking about water saturation?
Yes. We're on permafrost so that we can expect pretty much all summer it's going to be fairly wet.
How far down is it wet? How far down can you dig?
You can get down 2 to 3 feet probably at the most.
Should be a piece of cake. It shouldn't have any problem at all.
Okay, now even if that soil remains pretty well saturated all summer?
Well, if it looks like it's clay, it's not going to do well. But if you can raise the sand and organic material so that it's not sitting in water, quote unquote, the roots aren't going to go down that far. The roots won't go down. They'll radiate like the spokes of a wheel. They don't go down here at all anyway. So it really won't sit in water. It'll stay on the surface.
Okay. And one other question is, are there any specific types of raspberries or currants that you would recommend, and are there any tricks to keeping them going?
Yeah, that's a multiple question there. The best raspberry that we ever grew was one called Chief, which was out of northern Minnesota, and we still have a fair amount of them. They no longer grow them, but it was the number one marketing berry many years ago in Minnesota, and it's a good quality, very juicy, very sweet berry. It doesn't hold well in a pack like a Boynwell. Boyne seems to do fairly well. We're talking about raspberries now, okay? Mm-hmm. Kiska, I don't particularly care for it because it's more like a wild raspberry, but Kiska is a producing berry here.
Do people choose it because it's hardy? Is it hardier than the other varieties, or?
Well, the others are just they're fairly hardy. Mm-hmm. Boyne tends to be a little less hardy than Chief, but in most years there's no problem whatsoever on them. Latham, some people have Latham here. I can't seem to grow them. They don't seem to get above the. See, one of the problems with raspberries is they only produce on second year wood, and so. If the plant doesn't live over, you never get any raspberries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay? So you have to cane them every third year, which means you go through and you cut out the old dead wood after they leaf out, and then your suckers that come up alongside are the following year's crop producers.
So what about fertilization and that sort of thing? Anything special with regard to
Oh,
that?
Not really. No. No, good garden fertilizer is fine.
Okay. How about the currants?
Currants. Red Lake's probably the best of the commercial currants. Swedish black currant is a good black currant. A lot of people use those for sauces. I have my father put a portion of the row in years ago of the wild currant that's under cultivation in the nursery that's absolutely delightful and an excellent producer. So you could even try and move some
Transplant of the
wild currants as well.
Give them a little extra tender, loving care, and they do well.
Yeah, but they do very well under cultivation.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, they're huge. The row is like 3 feet wide and 3 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And millions of blossoms on them. So they're very good. More reliable than the commercial varieties.
Would it be better to plant raspberries and currants in basically the same microclimate?
I would think so.
Semi-shade or?
No.
Right out in the open?
You bet.
Okay.
Yeah. Raspberries are, we had an acre of them or half an acre of them on the farm. And my goodness, the Chief just were 3 foot wide rows and they were 4 and 5 feet tall. And I remember every lady from Fairbanks just about came out and picked them. So. Mm-hmm. They're excellent.
And they grow along the roads and the ditches from time to time.
Right,
find
the wild raspberry does, you bet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not a bad raspberry either. They're a little bit small. It takes
a big
bucket to make something with them, but they're not bad flavored.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
How about strawberries? Any special things about strawberries? Are they very good as perennials or...
Put an egg on my face. We lost our strawberries last year.
You did?
Because of this lousy winter.
Because of the lack of snow cover early on.
Yeah. We got Toklat, which is one that was developed at the university here. We have maybe 5 or 10% that lived. And it appeared the only ones that lived at all were some of the runners. But all of the, almost without exception, all of the second-year plants were done. And Pioneers, same thing. So... I just think it was the winter, and there's not much I can do about that, but mm-hmm. start over again.
And there are several annual varieties that if you plant now...
Quite a few annuals. Quinault is the one that's most commonly used. It's a good ever-bearing. Hecker is a good one.
The annuals seem to be a little more watery than...
Well, that's true with almost all the ones you buy in the store, too. If you notice that when you buy a little box of strawberries out of the store, they don't nearly have the flavor of the ones you pick out of the garden. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it's that you pick them a little more ripe out of the garden.
Well, actually, I don't know because I bought 25 raspberry plants and sort of it was along the driveway, and everyone who would come to see us would sort of browse along that strawberry
patch. So I never got any
between the birds and my guests. That was it for my straw. I think I'll put them in the back of the house this year. They're not listening.
Sounds like anybody who has children that grows carrots. How many carrots do you ever get out of your garden, really?
The kids pick them. You can plant. Do you advise planting some seeds? Actually,
I'd plant my whole garden right now if it can work the soil, if it's not too wet.
So all the seeds you can plant, and
to
leave the more delicate plants, but pansies and sweet peas, we could take a chance on.
Well, sweet pea plants, I don't think I'd take a chance on. You could plant the seed. General rule of thumb, I think I would hold off for the next couple of days. You know.
Okay.
It might not be best for people to purchase just to get their variety selections, you know, because so many people are. But
and all 40,000 of us can't get in the available nurseries
all the different
in
greenhouses
2 days that,
that are
critical.
No, not really.
I know I generally feel that nurseries can do a better job of taking care of the plants than I can, so I sort of like to wait till the last minute. So that whole routine, in and out, yeah. in and out with
well,
all
these. Well, that's probably pretty true, but at some point in time, one has to say, well, I better do the getting while the getting's good, you know.
I will say that there are many very good nurseries in town, and we also have a very good extension service that I would recommend anyone who's a newcomer who has questions about gardening at all to call. In addition, the nursery people in town I've found unfailingly helpful to me with all kinds of strange questions. And if you're new to gardening in Fairbanks, I really would say that it's better to ask, because there are some strange requirements and needs here, and it's really one of the most satisfying places to garden that I've ever gardened, because you don't have the pestilence and bug problems that I've had other places.
Well, we do have some, but you know, as a general thumb, we're pretty good. And I think, you know, I would just want everybody to know that if you are new to Fairbanks, that gardening here is absolutely tremendous. There are things you can do here that would scare you.
When you put in those pathetic little plants, you go into the greenhouses, and it's just a sea of green in all the nurseries, and you take them home, and you pull them out of their little six-packs or eight-packs, and you stick them in the ground, and they just look sad and pathetic. Even if you give them some shock treatment and you're real good to them. The thing that's wonderful about Fairbanks is in 2 weeks, you've got what looks like an established garden there.
Yeah, and in 6 weeks, you're drawn off it, you know, and that's really good.
You have to stay up all night to get the equal appreciation that you can get in a more traditional
right.
Summer in the Midwest, where you have April, May till the end of September, October, or something like that. So you have to sort of go short on sleep to appreciate it, but it is a very exciting experience here, and literally what keeps me going through my winters, just the thought of it. I've already got dirt all in my knuckles.
Even though it's so many hours a day, it's definitely well worth it here.
There's something about gardening that those of you out there who are gardeners know what I'm talking about. It's really rejuvenating. And I certainly don't expect to save money on it. It's a hobby, but it's cheaper than a lot of hobbies, so.
Well, I think so. And in a lot of ways, certain portions of gardening are quite financially rewarding in terms of what they
like
normally
what?
Cost.
What am I doing wrong? I spend a fortune on it.
Well, it depends what you grow. Like I said, you know, if you grow cabbage, you can buy cabbage cheaper in a store, although if you can grow the giant cabbage for the fair here, too.
Although you're quite right. I could not. I grow a lot of cut flowers because I really like cut flowers, and there's no way that I could afford to buy a house full of cut flowers for three continuous months.
No.
And I have that because I grow a garden. And, of course, the taste of vegetables out of the garden.
No comparison.
There just isn't any comparison. And those of us who are used to eating in Fairbanks less than perfect vegetables all winter sort of
owe ourselves that
kind of treat. So, well, I hope you're all enjoying your time out there gardening. You have 2 more days here before you have to get back to work on Tuesday. I thank you very much, Jim, for taking this time out. I know this is a really busy time of year for all the nursery people in town. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. Our executive producer is Carla Tonella, and happy gardening. This is Patty Kostelic. I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
This is KUAC-FM in Fairbanks, and it's 8 o'clock in the evening and time for Prairie Home Companion.
From Minnesota Public Radio.
following broadcast of A Prairie Home Companion is a recording of a live show from August of 1983.
Well, look who's coming through that door. I think we met somewhere before. Hello, love. Oh, yes. Hello, love. Well, where in the world you've been so long? I missed you so since you've been gone. Hello, love. Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to A Prairie Home Companion. Coming to you live from the World Theater in downtown St. Paul. Presented every Saturday night at this time by Minnesota Public Radio and by this public radio station. Brought to you by your friends in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota. With our special guests from New Orleans, Mr. Willie, Mr. Percy Humphrey with us. Fine band from the Faroe Islands, Bella Menonier is on hand. Mr. Greg Brown, Peter Ostrushko, Miss Stevie Beck and her auto harp, the Butch Thompson Trio. And also here, the Barrett sisters will be out to sing some gospel music for you. Brought to you by those powder milk biscuits. Oh, yes, they're tasty. And expeditious. Oh, hello, love. Thank you, and hello to you on a Saturday night. Welcome to this first portion of our show, brought to you by Powder Milk Biscuits, made from the whole wheat. Yes, indeed. We want to welcome Mr. Willie Humphrey back on our broadcast. He's been with us a couple of times before, never often enough, but he lives down in New Orleans. It's hard to get him away from there. And bringing with him today his brother on the trumpet, Mr. Percy Humphrey, the two of them, heard so often with the Preservation Hall New Orleans Jazz Band. I want to bring him up here with the Butch Thompson Trio and bring our young violinist up here to kick us off with a tune.
Oh, that's a great one. This is called Play Fiddle Play.
Now play fiddle play. Play my loved one a melody from the strings of your heart. Play fiddle, play, play my dear one a rhapsody. Play on the strings of her heart. Campfires are gleaming, bright as the sun. My heart is yearning, yearning for one. Play fiddle, loved one a rhapsody. Play on the strings of her heart. Thank you.
Mr. Peter Strusko and his fiddle Red Maddox were singing there with Percy and Willie Humphrey. Mr. Bill Evans back on the bass. And Mr. Butch Thompson himself seated right here at the piano.
How you doing?
Pretty good. Do us another tune. I'd do even better.
We're going to do a tune here that Percy's going to sing for us, and it's a number called Ice Cream. We're all going to scream for that stuff, ice cream. You'll listen to the vocal. You'll understand what I'm talking about.